A lot of people, I think, when they think of voice acting, they think of the voice part of it and not as much the acting part. And that's not necessarily done with accents or with pitch changes, but just with changing the character.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, Karen Hahn.
Karen, it is so nice to be co-hosting with you again. Before we get into the episode, whose voice did we hear at the top of the show, and where are some places we have probably heard her voice before?
That was Erika Ishii. She is a prolific actor and voiceover artist whose voice you may have heard in games such as Horizon Forbidden West, Halo Infinite, Deathloop, Psychonauts 2, Apex Legends, Young Justice. The list goes on and on. You have probably heard her in something.
You know, as soon as I'm done with Elden Ring, I'm on the final boss right now, and I just need a friend to help me beat him or them, I guess. I'm going to be playing Horizon Forbidden West, which she plays a number of roles in. So I'm excited to check this out and excited to check out our Slate Plus segment this week, which is...
So in the Slate Plus segment this week, we talk a little bit about their favorite performances from others, as well as a little bit about vocal warm-ups and just sort of, you know, being free with your voice.
That is awesome. I would not want to miss that. And, of course, if you subscribe to Slate Plus, you don't have to miss that. You can just go to slate.com/workingplus right now and sign up. It doesn't cost a lot of money, and you get access to everything behind the paywall at Slate. You get bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn, and which is coming back soon, and Big Mood, Little Mood. And you get to support everything we do right here on Working. So once again, go to slate.com/workingplus and sign up today. All right, let's listen in on Karen's conversation with actor and voiceover artist Erika Ishii.
Erika Ishii, thanks so much for coming on Working.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to start with the most recent game that I've played that you were in. Obviously, you have an incredibly impressive body of work, but very recently I was playing Horizon Forbidden West, which is one of the big releases of this year, a sequel to Horizon Zero Dawn. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like you did a little bit of motion capture for that game. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so I got to do facial capture in the booth for it because I was doing a couple of atmospheric characters, which was such an incredible, pleasant surprise because I was a huge fan of the first one.
Yeah, wait, so were you doing motion capture for or face capture for characters that you weren't voicing as well?
No, just for the ones that I was voicing, and so they could get all of the mouth animations and the facial animations and map them onto the characters.
Can you explain a little bit about what that recording process entails, as it were?
My experience is that sometimes when you go in the booth, they will put facial markers onto your face, you know, like you'll just draw on a bunch of dots on your face, and then you'll have like a head-mounted camera, sort of like a selfie GoPro, and it will map the dots, and then the animators will use that in aiding them to animate characters' faces. And it's really fun because it's kind of a cross between the voiceover and the in the voiceover booth and then doing the mocap on the stage, which is the thing that you see footage of a ton with everybody's got the little reflective dots and on their flattering Lycra bodysuit. And so this is a little bit of both of that, where it tracks, it captures the movement of the face, but also is directly capturing voiceover in like a high quality booth setting.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first time getting to do the facial dots because I'd done other performance capture on the stage, but it wasn't capturing my audio or my face. And I'd done a lot of voiceover where it was catching my voice, but not any of my movements. And so this was the coolest thing to get to do both. And for Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah.
And I haven't even gotten to play a ton of it.
Is it ever weird to play a game that you're in?
It's very, very weird. I, you know, all artists are a little bit self-critical. I've heard it said that, you know, by the time you're done with a project, you've already grown as an artist, and that's why you really hate how you were on that project where you were learning, which is a nice thought. But yeah, it does take me out of it a little bit, because the thing about games is they're so immersive. And when you're in there, you're, you know, you are the character and you're living in this world. And then I'm like, oh, is that what I sound like? Yeah.
I want to backtrack just very briefly. You were talking about like how with voice acting, it is often your voice that gets captured and not any part of your physical performance. How much of that when you're in the booth are you sort of thinking about, where it's like, I do need to still make this expression, or it is still helpful for me to gesture in some way, even if that's not going to translate to kind of the final thing that the developers are taking out of my voice performance?
Oh, constantly. There are some times where animators have captured video just for reference, to maybe pop in and give the character, you know, that particular face when I say a certain thing. But voice acting is very subtle. As somebody's done both on camera and voiceover, mm-hmm. voice acting is a lot subtler, where you have to really truly build the entire world with just your voice. And so mm-hmm. if you're you know, in the middle of something, you're kind of running, you know, your breath is very important, and it just picks up all of that. Or smiling, you can hear smiling, and that's one thing that they say in advertisements, where you can hear the smile. And you have to think about, how far is the person you're talking to? Is it cold? Are you moving around at all? There's mm-hmm. all these conditions that you have to adjust for with voiceover specifically, that you have to actively think about. Whereas in on camera, if you've been running, your character's been running, you've been running.
You have multiple roles in Horizon Forbidden West, and I'm curious, especially when you're in the space of one game, voicing multiple characters, what do you have to do to make sure that each of these things are distinct? Or what's your process for making sure that each of these characters is different, even though they are maybe smaller parts and all in the same world?
A lot of people, I think, when they think of voice acting, they think of the voice part of it and not as much the acting part.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that are just true chameleons, and you cannot tell that it's the same person. But a lot of times, it'll come down to the acting aspect of it. So you can have a character that still has kind of like a cool, husky voice, but they'll be shyer, or you can age up a character or make a voice sound younger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily done with accents or with pitch changes, but just with changing the character.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on if they're talking to each other or not, because if they're talking to each other, you got to make them sound real different. But sometimes they're in, you know, especially in a game like Horizon Forbidden West, it's, you know, a massive world. And so if in a couple of side quests later, you run into a character that also has sounds a little bit like me, then that's probably, you know, there's 80 hours in there in the main quest. You're probably okay.
And I want to ask about one, this is sort of a silly question, but a huge part of these big video games is barks, which for those who aren't familiar with the term, is like the sort of smaller repeated dialogue. Like if you bump into a character, they'll go like, ugh, or like, what? Why'd you hit me? Et cetera.
Yeah.
But there's so many different variations of that. I'm curious if you find that a fun or tedious or difficult part of the process.
I love efforts and barks. It's, you know, I mean, I you know, as somebody who kind of came up in video games, and especially in military games or fighting games, efforts, which are the efforts that you make when you move, and barks, which are like grenade or get down, you know, kind of become, you know, part of your bag of tricks, and you, you have to be able to sort of like slip into it and know, again, how far away, how projected is it? Is it, are you on comms? So you're right in somebody's ear, you know, like how much effort are you exerting? And just being able to pull them up really quickly and be able to go down the line on them, because oftentimes you'll just get, most of the time, it's just a spreadsheet. The script is a spreadsheet, and they'll just kind of go down and highlight the box and be like, okay, we need three getting hit. Okay, now three hitting, small, medium, large. And just being able to have that as like a, in your Swiss Army knife of tools is so important because there's different kinds of barks or efforts depending on what kind of game, you know? Is it a Japanese fighting game, or is it, you know, like a grounded American AAA, or, you know, and just sort of knowing what I want to hear in different games has been super helpful.
I want to get a little bit more into your experiences doing body motion capture, because obviously, like, walk cycles are such a huge part of video games, too, where it's, like, making a character walk realistically. So, like, what kind of things are they asking you to do? Like, is it having to learn fight choreography for a fight, or is it getting those naturalistic movements, or getting kind of the more outsized ones? What kind of experience have you had in that field?
So remember how I said that voiceover and on-camera acting were two very different kinds of acting? I would also probably put motion capture and performance capture in a different category from those two, because it really honestly depends. For motion capture, they're just getting sort of the movements, sometimes the stunts. Performance capture, you know, you're performing the entire scene, and it is like more akin to stage acting than it is even to film TV acting, because you have to go through the whole script and you have to have it memorized. But it's, you know, there's no stopping in the same way that there is for film and TV. There are some performers that are mocap performers that do primarily stunts and the walk cycles and the physicality. There's some that do all of it, the voiceover and the motion. I've gotten to do a little bit of all of it, where, you know, I was doing mocap for somebody, for a character whose voice was already there, or performance capture, or, you know, the facial capture where it's like just the face dots in the booth. I love performance capture. I love performance capture. It's like black box theater where you have to imagine everything. And that's why it's more like stage acting. It's like you're in these very vulnerable suits, and you have not even real furniture, sometimes not even real items. And you just have to completely shut it all out and recreate the environments and the circumstances and the physics of a world, a completely different world. So that's a whole other set of skills. And I have sort of some martial arts training and some gun fight training, just because, you know, I do want to be in these serious shooty games. So that's, like, those are some important skills to have for it.
Yeah. And I also want to talk about one of your biggest roles recently, which is the role of Valkyrie in the game Apex Legends. You said in an interview, she's one of the most real characters I've ever had the honor of portraying. And I was hoping you would talk to us a little bit more about this character and why, I guess, she is important to you.
Valkyrie is, Valkyrie is definitely the closest to my heart, in part because I wanted it so badly. You know, I was a fan of Apex, and I actually had friends that worked on the game, both as voice actors and developers. And I loved the world building, and I loved the representation that I saw even at launch. They launched with two black women and a gay man and a non-binary non-binary character, which I'm not sure. I think Bloodhound might have been the first non-binary character. And it was just so amazing for the people that don't normally get to play as themselves in these sorts of games to suddenly have a character that they could see themselves as, that they could see themselves being a hero or even in some cases a jerk and like a really complicated, messy person. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that really stuck out to me about Valkyrie, is that Valkyrie was messy. I feel like, you know, I'm sure you know that, you know, as an Asian femme, there are so few examples of diverse representation that when you have one, it's like they have to encompass all of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they have to represent their people and, you know, be perfect or really cool.
Yeah, the weirdly
cool
monolithic thinking. Yeah.
Very monolithic thinking is a great way to put it. And Valkyrie is kind of a mess, you know? She's got daddy issues and she's a heavy drinker, but like she's also this ace pilot, you know? Like they gave sort of references of like Maverick from Top Gun, who's super messy, and Starbuck, and that's just not the kind of character that I would have ever gotten to play or audition for, even in coming up in on camera acting. Mm-hmm. And she's also queer. She's a lesbian, a very out and very loud, messy lesbian. And that's just she was so unique and she was so one of a kind. And I also had the honor of getting to sort of work with the team on aspects of her personality, mm-hmm. you know, like, sort of little touches of lines that they let me play around with. And mm-hmm.
That's incredible. And I love hearing that you were able to sort of build that character with the team, because I feel like it's always special when that happens.
Yeah, and it's actually not that common for mm-hmm. a voice actor to get to have input at all in their character.
Right.
You know, most of the time we come in a lot later in the process, in a way that's like very removed from the whole development process. And as I said, you know, we're reading down an Excel sheet. You know, we don't necessarily know what we're reacting to or mm-hmm. what the character looks like. But in some cases, like with Valkyrie, there was a lot for me to go off of.
Mm-hmm. There was one part of what you were saying about Valkyrie that I want to talk about as well, which is you were saying that you didn't really feel like you had the opportunity to play a character like this who was so close to you and also kind of so real in the live action sector, as it were. I guess, well, how have you noticed like that changing both in the gaming industry and also like on the live action side, as far as, I guess, playing characters who aren't supposed to be that kind of monolith, or how common that is, rather?
It's a completely different world than when I was growing up.
Hmm.
You know, the kind of movies and characters that I see now and that I get to play in gaming mm-hmm. are just worlds away from anything that was available to me. I mean, I remember growing up and there was Sulu and the Yellow Power Ranger, and Lauren Tom played all of the Asian animated characters, and she's a hero of mine. And that was, you know, that was sort of the very narrow scope in American television and mm-hmm. and media. But now I think there's so much more attention to authenticity, both in who's playing a character and their portrayal on screen or in the game, and so much more media being created by Asian Americans and Asian diaspora, and really like just the more voices you have in all aspects of it, the better it's going to be. There's more. You're empowered to speak up more, and mm-hmm. There are more stories by us, you know. And one huge shift was that we all got tired of it. We all got tired of it, and then we started telling the stories that we wanted to see in the world.
Definitely. And I do want to talk about your beginnings as a voice actor, but I was also looking at your IMDb page, and your first credit is a role on Full House, which was so, so both surprising and funny for me to see. How did that happen?
So I did the whole child actor thing. My parents were below-the-line workers in Hollywood. They met. My mom was a film editor, and my dad was a camera assistant. Mm-hmm. So when I, at a very early age, I was very rambunctious and extroverted, and I obviously loved performing. So they figured, oh, well, maybe Erica would like acting. And then, you know, I did Barbie commercials and little educational films. And yeah, an episode of Full House is probably the biggest one. And I still get 16-cent residual checks from that one episode. I mean, I loved it because, you know, I got to grow up around the showbiz, but my parents were never pushy about it. They were just like, well, as long as you want to do it, you can do that. And I did it. Like, I took a break from it because I was a very awkward-looking teenager, and I focused on school and violin. But then, you know, I came back to it. It's just something that I knew that I loved, and I was very lucky to have parents that were supportive of that.
Was there a particular moment after that break where you were like, I know that this is the moment that I want to go back in. I have to do this again now.
Yeah, I was working as a temp for a contractor for a city business tax division. it was, you know, I was, you know, a struggling artist and stuff. I was lucky enough to be living with my mom, though, you know, like an hour out of the city. So, you know, that's one thing that a lot of up and coming actors don't have that I was privileged to have. But it was a rough time emotionally for me. And I remember, you know, I was taking improv classes and acting classes. I was still sort of going out for it on the side, but I just had working full time. I had zero time to pursue acting, and so I quit, and they were like, we'll offer you more money and better hours, and I was like, no, I hate it here, and I've gotta try, or I will never be happy for the rest of my life. So I got a catering job and went harder into acting, and yeah, I got very lucky.
We'll be back with more of Karen's conversation with Erica Ishii after this.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, listeners, you may have noticed that we have a new bonus show every other week called Working Overtime. And part of what we're trying to do with that show is to answer listener questions and to help you out with advice on your creative problems. So if you've got something you'd like to tell us about or ask us about, or a guest you'd like to recommend, or something that's working for you, or a problem that you are having, drop us a line. You can email us at working@slate.com or leave us a voicemail at 304-933-WORK. Oh, and by the way, if you are enjoying this show, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's rejoin Karen's conversation with voiceover artist Erica Ishii.
So what sparked your interest in voice acting, or what kind of made you think, like, this is a route that I really want to take? I've read that the game The Last of Us was a very influential part of that decision.
The Last of Us was the tipping point where I said, oh, this is specifically what I want to do, and I am going to go into voiceover, because I grew up loving video games, and I grew up loving animation. Actually, I have a family history in animation. My grandpa was an animator. But, you know, it's a different track than on-camera acting, you know, because there is an expensive buy-in for your first voiceover reel is going to be about $800 to $1,000, and you got the equipment, and it's a different kind of acting that you might need to take lessons for. And, you know, so and I didn't want to, like, split my resources, but I just had to, you know, I had to go after voiceover in that way, because The Last of Us and some other games around that time just showed that you could really have some meaty, interesting, complex roles in video games. And I wanted that so badly. And so getting to be in The Last of Us 2 was kind of my benchmark of, I'm getting to do this.
And I also wanted to ask, I think the answer might be no, just based on what you're saying about voicing the atmospheric characters, but do you have a different approach for TV or film versus video game roles when it comes to voiceover work?
The difference of animation versus video games is significant, actually.
Okay.
But mostly it's about genre. Genre is almost more important than whether it's TV, film versus video games, because, knowing whether it's a Nickelodeon show or some sort of grounded Netflix cartoon.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but generally, the things that I tend to get cast for, both in animation and games, is sort of like, oh, we're looking for grounded and more realistic, you know, just because I have that kind of voice. And I can do cartoony voices, and I have done, like, children and really broad characters. But I think where my voice comfortably lives and where people hear me and think, oh, we should bring Erica in to audition for this, is from, you know, sort of realistic and grounded games.
I'm also curious about, you've done some dubs for some animes. For listeners who might not be as familiar, it's the process of taking a show that's originally in a different language and then doing the English voices for the roles over it. I think most recently you played the role of Artemisia in Fina, Pirate Princess. And I wanted to know what it's like to take on a role where it's already sort of predetermined how a character is going to sound, and then working kind of within that space.
For dubbing, it's kind of a toss-up on whether they want you to sound like the original voice actor or not. I tend to get cast when I do dubbing as characters that are sort of tougher or have lower voices. Originally, I thought that I'd be doing, like, sort of anime ingenue roles, like young girls. That was before my voice sort of got even lower, and before, you know, and before I realized, you know, this sort of my skill set lay in more serious and tough characters. But the technical skill that anime really requires is timing, is being able to act within a small space. You match the lip flaps, so you watch the animation back, and you have to match the translated dialogue to the animation that's already there. And that is such a technical skill, and I have so much respect for anybody who does that for dubbing. Like, you'll see people just fly through those scripts and like, be able to see it through once and then perfectly match the dialogue while conveying an emotion. And that's an incredibly technical skill. I haven't done as much dubbing, to be honest with you, and it's anime companies don't pay very well for dubbing, despite the fact that anime is this huge and booming industry. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I know a lot of anime actors are pushing on and finally speaking up about.
Yeah, that's actually something that we talk a lot about on Working, the idea of like time versus money, like how much time you can afford to spend on a project you might really want to do if it's not paying you really well, especially because so much of the creative professions that we cover are fields where you're not necessarily salaried and you have to sort of build your income by yourself as opposed to relying on a single source. How did you navigate that kind of earlier in your career in terms of what roles you wanted or wanted to take or didn't want to take, but maybe had to, as opposed to now? Like, do you feel like you have a little more freedom?
Yeah, I mean, as an actor, especially starting out, you just say yes to everything. Although mm-hmm. I will say that I have never knowingly taken a role where the character was Black or Latinx. Mm-hmm. Or a marginalized culture that I have no claim to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, look, if you're an up-and-coming actor and you got to do it, like, I get it. Like, you got to pay your rent. And I will never judge somebody for that. But I, for me, have always valued authenticity mm-hmm. in roles. And so that's one rule that I am hard and fast on. And even earlier on, you know, turned down things that were pretty big where I was like, I wouldn't feel right about this.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that now, yeah, just being able to do all union work,
mm-hmm.
getting to gravitate towards characters and specifically target audition for characters that are interesting to me and mm-hmm. not audition for every single,
right.
you know, soldier number one sort of role is an immense privilege. Because I remember starting out when I'd get maybe one voiceover audition a month or so. And so mm-hmm. every single one was so precious. And I'd like try my hardest at it. And I'd like want it so badly, and I'd accept almost any of the auditions, whether it was for something non-union or mm-hmm. you know, tiny characters that maybe weren't as exciting to me. But yeah, now realizing, okay, like if I miss this one job, it's not the end of the world, and I can still pay my rent is mm-hmm. It's still so wild for me. I don't know if I'll ever quite get used to it.
Yeah. And I think also like coming to a place where you feel comfortable negotiating for what you've set as your rate is also really huge. Because especially, again, early on, you're like, any money is still money and I will take that. But figuring out like what you've set, like I still feel nervous like when I have to negotiate for that kind of stuff where I'm like, oh, like I shouldn't ask for more because I'm lucky to be getting paid anything at all.
Oh, that's why I got a guy for that, you know? I mean, honestly, shout out to my agents, you know, over at A3, you know, coming up, you know, it's like I told them, like, I don't want to take these kinds of roles or, like, and when I told them, like, send me non-binary or gender fluid stuff, they were like, gotcha. We understand mm-hmm. completely. We're going to pitch you correctly. And my manager, who is my ride or die over at Bohemia, who, yeah, like has backed me up in so many negotiations, but also in saying no, because saying mm-hmm. no was hard and saying no to work, even to things that I wanted to do, but that were like, okay, like my bandwidth is stretched mm-hmm. or I want to do this, but they're really not paying like a fair wage mm-hmm. is like having somebody else to be the bad guy for you is, well worth the percentage that they take. More than worth it. More than worth it. But yeah, it's especially in, you know, in freelance, because, you know, I was also doing just freelance non-acting and non-performing mm-hmm. jobs before that. And, you know, having to advocate for yourself is terrifying and not always feasible because you do, you know, there are times where you just do need the money. Or in the case of, acting, you need the exposure. You need the exposure or the experience. And there's something to be said for paying your dues, right? Of you know, volunteering on your friends' projects and, you know, getting that reel together. But then past a certain point, it's exploitation. It's exploitation. Yeah. And people, even in the come up, I hope, will be able to advocate for themselves because, you know, it's a labor rights issue and it's about sort of holding employers to a certain standard and asking for your worth.
Mm-hmm. Was there a specific point in your career where you sort of started thinking about that more? Because again, I do feel like especially early in any given art, creative career, it's you almost aren't thinking about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. At first it was, you know, I used to be like, hey, I'll do anything. I'll say yes to anything, right? Mm-hmm. You say yes to everything. You pay your dues. And then it became, okay, well, I do need it to be one of three things, which is it has to be something I am, like, very passionate about, you know, something I care about or with friends. Or it has to be exposure or good for the brand and, like, really good. We're not talking, like, hey, you know, you get an IMDb credit. Or number three, it pays, you know, and it pays fairly. And it had to be one of those three things. And then I remember the years that it had to be two of those things. And then now it kind of has to be all of them, especially working on union projects, you know, and, you know, there's a set union rate. And I mean, for voiceover, I'll still pretty much take any union job because I love being in video games.
Thank you so much again, Erica, for coming on the show. It was such a delight to talk to you and a very eye-opening conversation as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Karen, I loved this conversation because you really helped illuminate a kind of acting that most of us experience all the time but probably don't think about, namely the voices we hear on video games. So I'm going to start with a doozy, the $10 million question. In the age of motion capture and face capture, when the voice, body, and face of a character might be supplied by three different people and then animated and altered later, what even is acting and what is good acting?
I guess to start kind of at the beginning of what you're saying, I think you sort of have to take it part by part. Ideally, obviously, all the components of a performance like this will be will work seamlessly together, but that's not always the case. Obviously, if you're only supplying one of these components, that's the only part that you have any control over as an artist. And I think ultimately there's no harm in singling one point out, like saying, I really loved this voice performance, but I thought the animation just wasn't there. And I also don't think that compartmentalizing like that means that it's bad acting just because there's so much that's gone into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's also the same thing, I think, like when you say, like, I didn't like this movie, but I really thought the score was really good, or I thought this one performance was really good. But I guess, quote unquote, good acting for me can be boiled down to how much you believe that performance to be true, as opposed to thinking, oh, that's a person doing a performance.
Yeah, totally. You know, for me in video games, it's often when they've over animated the gestures because real people don't move their arms all the time when they talk. But in video games, you're almost like, are you doing calisthenics? Like, what is going on? Because, you know, like everything has this, you know, this key gesture. I loved Erica's adage that when you look back at your past work, you're not being super critical of it because it's bad. You're super critical of it because you've grown.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of another thing that people told me as I was finishing my book, that, you know, you have to become the artist worthy of the work. I grew a lot writing my book. You are closing in on the final phases of yours, and mazel tov on that, by the way.
Thank you.
Are you feeling any of this right now?
Definitely a little bit, but weirdly, I think I felt it more in the second or third kind of draft edit phases as opposed to where I am right now, which is the proofing phase. It's been sort of a comfort for me to go through proofing because as I've read over the chapters to catch any like last small mistakes, I've sort of been like, hey, I think I actually did a pretty good job with this book. I feel like the reaction that we're talking about right now, where you can be very critical of something that you did in the past, not because it's bad, but because you're better now, I feel it a lot more in terms of my past cultural criticism.
Right.
And I think that is partially due to the fact that I just couldn't spend as much time on it, because a lot of the stuff that I was doing when I was still really in the thick of media and the journalism, you get the assignment in the morning, you finish it by like 3 or 4 p.m., and
right.
then that's it. That's all you can do on it, as opposed to this book, which I've been working on for almost 2 years.
Yeah, totally, totally. When I got my first page proofs, I was like, oh no, I failed. This book is a disaster. But by the end of the process, I felt really good about it. So I'm glad. But no, I know what you mean. Like, you look back at an old piece and you're like, the me of today would have done a better job with this.
Right.
You know, this review of whatever this movie is or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Although I'll also say that I had a sort of comforting moment recently, because one of the top editors that I only email with, like, kind of when things are in final stages or big decisions, he emailed mm-hmm. me recently and was like, hey, can I talk to you about like another idea? And I was like, oh, if they're saying that, then that means I did a good job with this one, hopefully.
That is amazing. That's so great. Your discussion of Barks and Efforts was a mm-hmm. good reminder of exactly how much work goes into making these things. And that work is done by hundreds of people, many of whom are non-union and working crazy hours. You know, we were talking yeah. about Elden Ring right before we recorded this thing. And I mean, that's a vast world. And it feels like someone has thought about every blade of grass in that game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely crazy. My wife was surprised to learn that Elden Ring costs the same amount as other games. She's like, shouldn't it cost
yeah.
more given how huge it is? I was like, actually, no, they all cost $60 or whatever.
Yeah.
As you've learned more about the industry and how it works, has it changed the way you view games, either while you're playing them or reviewing them or whatever?
Yeah, actually working on a video game and writing like the scripts and Barks and Efforts, it has really mm-hmm. made me appreciate the work that goes into a game a lot more. It's sort of like, this is sort of circular thinking, but once you actually make the sausage, you really appreciate how the sausage gets
yeah,
made.
Yeah, totally,
you know?
Totally.
And for like Barks and stuff, now that when I'm playing games and I hear this kind of like background dialogue sound really effortless and also not repetitive, it makes me really, really impressed, because when I go in and try to write that stuff, it's so hard to come up with these variations that sound fresh or otherwise like aren't really awkward because you're laboring to say the same thing in a different way. And then there's also stuff like knowing that people have to write with what assets are made in mind. For instance, like the video game that myself and my writing partner were working on, there were some lines where we were like, oh, can we talk about like a soda can? Like, does that asset exist? And they were like, yes, but you can, if you want to talk about like a label or a brand, you can only do these three things because that's what we have. That's what we've made. So
amazing.
There's a lot to think about.
That's wild. I also love when you exhaust the dialogue tree and then the guy's just repeating the like, I think that mine's full of ghosts.
Maybe don't go in there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I really appreciated your discussion with Erica about the ways in which representation mm-hmm. has changed. That, you know, when there's fewer roles for a specific identity group, each of those roles takes on this huge burden of representation. And then that lightens a bit and makes both writing and performing freeing and easier as more characters and stories come into play. And I think a lot about what you've done on this show since you took over as co-host, that, you know, you're featuring a lot of Asian women and through that you're showing like an enormous amount of diversity. And so none of those guests have to check every box, you know, they can just mm-hmm, kind of mm-hmm. be themselves. Erica seemed very optimistic about the moment we are in and the progress we have made. And I was just wondering how you're feeling about it.
Overall, I really agree with what they were saying about being like optimistic about progress, just because I think it's a huge thing that progress is being made at all, because for such a long time, it just wasn't.
Yeah.
But I will say that I feel cautiously optimistic, because there's kind of a twofold trap in the way that we think about this kind of thing. I think that one, our inclination to not say anything critical about something that is diverse because it could be viewed as forcing a step backward or saying it's bad because of this. For instance, like when Crazy Rich Asians came out, I think it was so hard to say it's an okay movie. It's not a masterpiece, just because it was so important that this was like the first movie in such a long time or ever that had an all Asian primary cast, an Asian director. That was huge. And it felt like you couldn't say anything bad about it because it would be taking a step back in some respect.
It's so funny you say that because someone got mad at me on a podcast when I said that I thought it was an okay movie. So like I know exactly the thing you're talking about. Or when the all-female Ghostbusters came out, which is also like an okay, maybe a little less than okay movie, but like people had to talk about it like it was much, much better than it actually was, you know, because they felt that pressure.
I think it kind of ate itself in that respect, where it was either you have to say you love it or people hated it for misogynistic reasons.
Where I was just sort of like, well, it does seem like they cut some important scenes out. Like the movie almost doesn't make sense. Like that was my critique of it. It wasn't like women can't be funny.
Right. Yeah. Like it's so hard, especially now. I think it's hard to critique anything, like regardless of what it is, just because of the way that internet culture has kind of progressed to where they're... A lot of people seem to think there is just this binary of I love it or I hate it, which is not really how you should approach art. But as far as what I was saying, I think the second part of the trap is that the corporate instinct to any successful project is generally to take the wrong lessons from why it was successful.
Yes.
Like, I think the most recent example was Everything Everywhere All at Once did so, so well at the box office and is also very critically acclaimed because it's a great movie. But then there was that Variety piece that was like, it's successful because people love multiverses. And it was like, no. Like, that's not the lesson that we should be taking away from this film. Like, the reason that people like it is because it's so fresh and original, and also because it's addressing these ideas from a very specific point of view, from a specific like Asian immigrant point of view, and particularly from like this middle-aged mother and her daughter's point of view. Like that's what makes that movie great. It's not that, oh, there's a million multiverses. Like that's not what we should be taking away from that.
Also, it's like, as anyone who grew up watching Hong Kong cinema could tell you, like Michelle Yeoh's a fucking star. She was already a fucking star to like billions of people. And it was just sort of about time that America figured that out. You know, it's funny. The other thing that you say there that is that I just want to underscore, because you and I are both critics as well as creators, that this really points to why one of the reasons why you need diverse critics, beyond the fact that we need diverse critics anyway. There's a million different reasons, including it's the right thing to do. But one of the reasons is so that actually people aren't afraid to say like, yeah, this thing doesn't work that well. They don't feel that same pressure. You know what I mean? Because like, you know, they could be more honest about the work they're seeing.
But it's also like sort of on the flip side of the coin. It's like if you just produced more Asian art, like we wouldn't feel
No. I agree with that.
Pedestalize like Crazy Rich Asians. Like just give the creatives a chance to actually make stuff, and then you're sort of bypassing one of these huge problems just completely.
Yes. I loved their description of the arc of a career being in part about the increased freedom to say no to things.
Yeah.
It was such a realistic and refreshing way to think about it. You know, early on, you say yes to everything unless it crosses some personal ethical line. And in their case, it was, I didn't want to play someone from a marginalized community who wasn't Asian. Right. Which makes total sense. And then as you go along, you start to learn how to say no to things, and you start to make the kind of money, hopefully, in part thanks to unions, where you can say no to things. And I have to say, I feel like maybe, I guess my second book's out, so I'm probably like a mid-career writer now. And I still find saying no to things to be an incredible challenge. I'm still like so grateful that someone wants me to do something that I have to wait a second and be like, do I even have time to do this? You know, what about you? You know, you're finishing this first book. You know, how are you navigating this?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with everything that you and also Erica said, where it's like, it's so hard to say no early on. And I think especially if you don't come from a place of privilege, even in your mid or late career, it's still hard to say no, because you were still thinking about, oh, I should be making money. I should be spending this time doing something that will support me so that I can live and eat comfortably.
Right.
That said, I think it's gotten easier for me to say no to stuff because I've learned more about the industries that I'm in, and I'm a little more clear-eyed about the things that people want me to do. For instance, like being asked to talk about something Asian culture related because a publication doesn't have any Asian writers on staff, or being asked to come on a podcast that has never reached out to me before, specifically because they're talking about something that has Asian influences or characters in it. Like, I appreciate the invitation, obviously. Like, the fact that you thought of me and thought I would make a good guest is really flattering and is something that's valuable to me. But at the same time, I want to know that this is not something that you are doing specifically because you need to check a box. Like, if I'm looking at past pieces on the site or past episodes, and the only times that a POC, like freelancers or writers, are brought in is for those things.
Yeah, that just feels like tokenism, right?
It feels really, really bad. And I I remember seeing like a lot of tweets. I see these tweets every Black History Month where Black writers are like, editors, please just hire some Black staffers instead of only giving them assignments this month, which is so, so true and so, so depressing. That said, on a broader level, I'm learning to say no to stuff for other reasons, for instance, like just not having time to do it or not really being interested in the topic that I'm being pitched. And that is really only possible because I have a cushion, because I have achieved like some relative success in my field, and also because I have a very supportive partner. If I didn't have those things, it would be impossible for me to turn things down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just think it's a real weird as you enter your mid-career. I'm in the middle of it now, and you as a younger and more precocious and accomplished person are in the middle of it now, too.
No, that's not
just
true.
It's just a weird thing to just be like, oh, actually, I don't want to do this and don't have time to do it, and it's okay for me to say no.
It's also, we're speaking about it very generally, but there's so many factors, too. Like, if someone came to you and was like, we'll give you $50,000 to write a book about a topic that you're just lukewarm on, it's still going to be really hard. Because, like,
yes,
a book is huge.
Yeah, like, if someone came to me and said, here's $50,000 to write about Crazy Rich Asians, I don't know that I'd say yes to that.
Well, also, you probably shouldn't. I don't think you're the right person to write that book. Isaac, I love you so much, but
I am definitely the wrong person to write that book for all sorts of reasons. That's all the time we have this week. If you've enjoyed this show as much as we have recording it, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And yes, once again, here's the Slate Plus pitch. Slate Plus subscribers get a cornucopia of goodies, including full access to the website, bonus segments on shows like this one, bonus full episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood, and you get the best thing of all, feeling morally superior to your friends and loved ones because you're supporting great work all over this site, including what we do right here on Work. Go to slate.com/workingplus to sign up today.
Thank you so much to Erica Ishii for being our guest this week. And thanks, as always, to our incredible producer, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Isaac's interview with Steph Paynes, the founder and guitarist for Led Zeppelin, the all-female Led Zeppelin Experience. Until then, get back to work.
Dun diggity gunk, dun diggity gunk, dun diggity gunk, dun diggity gunk.
Ah! Yeah, is that good?